out on strike earlier this summer, President Reagan declared that they were no longer government employees because they had sacrificed their jobs when they broke their no-strike oath. We're going to spend the final hour of Fresh Air today talking about some of the background and precedents of labor history that come into play in understanding the strike and the effects that it will have on American labor in the future. With me for a return visit to Fresh Air is labor historian Philip Foner. He's the author of many books on American labor history, some of which are used as texts in college classes. His books include his four-volume history of the labor, his five-volume history of the labor movement in the United States, Organized Labor and the Black Worker, and his recent two-volume book, Women and the American Labor Movement. He's been a professor of American history at Lincoln University, a visiting professor at Rutgers. He's taught at many different places around the world. Next week, he leaves for China to teach at a university there. In January, he's off to Cuba to teach at a university in Cuba, courses on the history of American labor. He's been with us in the past to discuss labor history and black history. Last week, he spoke with us about the American Communist Party and the labor movement, and that was after an interview that we broadcast with Gus Hall. In a little while on Fresh Air, we'll be opening up the telephones for your questions and comments. By the way, Philip Foner leaves tomorrow for China. Welcome back to Fresh Air.
Welcome and goodbye.
That's right. When did it become illegal for government workers to strike?
Well, there is no exact date. The laws were passed in various states declaring strikes illegal, and then finally in Congress passed a law declaring it illegal for public employees to strike, and in the negotiations with the unions, that was part of the understanding. But it doesn't always mean that just because laws are passed, they were lived up to or entirely enforced in every case. I'll give you a concrete example of how it became impossible to follow a hard line in dealing with these questions. In New York in 1947 passed a law called the Conlin-Wadlin Bill. And that provided that not only were New York State public employees was it illegal for them to strike, but if they did, they would lose their jobs. And if anyone was rehired, he would have to be on probation for 5 years. Never could be enforced. It just found that it was difficult to carry this thing into effect. So it was replaced in the 1960s by a law called the Taylor Law. And that didn't call for automatic dismissal of public employees, but provide that if public employees did go on strike, why, they would be fined for every day they were on strike and deducted from their salaries. Even that was never enforced until recently in the last transit strike in New York City. So in 1970, during the Nixon administration, postal employees went on strike, and they were not only not punished, but after the strike was over, they negotiated an agreement which gave them everything they had gone on strike for. So what happened in this particular instance of the air controllers is very unprecedented in terms of the hard line that was taken against them.
What is the rationale for having a no-strike policy towards public employees?
Well, the rationale is that if you are a public employee, you somehow surrender certain rights. That's one rationale. Another rationale is that public safety is involved, public security. Of course, there's this famous precedent that the Reagan administration likes to point to, namely the statement of then-Governor Calvin Coolidge in Massachusetts, who broke the Boston police strike of 1919 with the, and in doing so made the statement that there is no right anytime, anywhere, under any circumstance to risk or to have any effect on public safety or public security. But this is a very general kind of thing because, first of all kinds of different employees are involved. In one case, a policeman, you can't put policemen on the same level with postal employees in terms of that. Now, a bigger question that is involved is, do public employees have the same rights under the Constitution as private employees? Now, according to President Reagan, they don't. Because if you were to have the air pilots go on strike, as they have on quite a few occasions, being employed by the airlines, even though that would endanger the whole operation of the air traffic system, they would not be able to be punished for violating anything. I can't foresee that one of the leaders of the Air Pilots Association would have been taken to prison in shackles because of that, as was a member of a leader of the PATCO group. But isn't it strange that people who do work in the same industry, just because they are employed by the federal government, are suddenly deprived of rights which others would have and become criminals in the eyes of the government for refusing to accept an agreement which they felt not only was bad for them, but endangered the safety of American passengers because of the difficult conditions under which they worked, incidentally, which President Reagan acknowledged when he asked them for their vote in the 1980 campaign. But getting back to this question of public employees, last week there was a very interesting decision in West Virginia by the Supreme Court of West Virginia that I think applies very clearly to this situation. The West Virginia Supreme Court dismissed a damage suit arising out of a public employee strike. That is, the city of Fairmont, West Virginia, instituted a damage suit against nurses who are public employees who went on strike and claimed that they should be punished for what they had done. The Supreme Court threw that out. Now, they did not do this, the city of Fairmont, on the ground that they had no right to strike under the law, because there is no law in West Virginia that public employees cannot strike. Not every state has such a law. But they argued it on the basis of the common law. That is, public employees under the common law give up the right to strike. The West Virginia Supreme Court not only rejected that, but said, and this is very interesting, because in the majority decision, except for one, it was almost a unanimous decision, Justice Darrow McGraw rejected the idea that public employees do not have the same First Amendment rights as private employees. He says they have the same First Amendment rights as private sector workers. Their right to collective bargaining is not created by federal labor legislation, but stems from the Constitution itself. In other words, the Bill of Rights gives them the same right to bargain collectively as it gives private employees. In West Virginia, he went on, the right to protest against the policies of government and the right to seek redress from the government without fear of reprisal are as fundamental to our law and good sense as cornbread and beans are to our diet. Now, why is that valid in West Virginia, and why shouldn't it be valid in terms of the national government? I agree that public employees do have the same First Amendment rights as private employees, and what we are seeing now is unprecedented. In other words, we are seeing an effort to destroy a union, and that for doing something which others would not be punished in the same way. Okay.
The president would say, I'm sure, that he didn't make this law. He's enforcing the law. They all, when they were hired, signed oaths saying that they wouldn't strike and that if they meant to strike, they shouldn't have signed the oath.
All public employees. If you were to apply the same principle, then you would simply have to fire and destroy every public employees union the moment there is a strike. That has not been the case.
What other public employees unions have recently struck?
Well, in various cities. You've had firemen and policemen in Minneapolis, in Kansas, and many other places, in San Francisco. In New York City, the transit employees went on strike in violation of the Taylor Act. And it's not impossible that Philadelphia, which has known public employee strikes in the past, may face another one. In none of these cases were the workers dismissed or the union smashed. In the end, they compromised, they agreed, they arbitrated, but they worked it out. This is the only case where this has actually happened in this way. And what makes it, I'll give you another example. The air controllers did do something 10 years ago, 1970. They had many grievances for a long time. And this, in 1970, instead of going on strike, they went on a slowdown. In fact, some people feel they should have done it now, too, you see. But what happened? At that time, and it was the Republican administration. Usury, who was the secretary, assistant secretary of labor for public employees, was confronted with the demand that the union be decertified because it had gone on a slowdown, which is what the government is doing now, you see. And his answer was that would be unfair. It would be depriving these workers of a right which they have under collective bargaining rights in our Constitution and in the law. But that seems to have escaped the present administration. And what's the difference between a slowdown and a strike? I mean, in one sense, a slowdown is even worse, you might say. Air controllers have struck all over Europe again and again and again, and Canada. They have negotiated with them. They've not destroyed their unions.
From other examples of public employee strikes, what kind of support have they gotten from other organized labor?
It varies. It's very difficult to say yes in most cases. In some cases, they have gotten a great deal of support in terms of other unions going on strike. In other cases, they've been support in the form of actual funds, etc. In very few cases have other unions gone in and taken the places of public employees. It's difficult to say. But there have been a number of cases where public employees have been part of a general strike in which all together have worked together. For example, Philadelphia is a good example of that because the first general strike anywhere in the world occurred in Philadelphia in 1835. It started on the Schuylkill River with the Irish coal heavers demanding the 10-hour day, and they were fired by their employers for refusing to work unless they got the 10-hour day. Other workers joined their strike and went out for the 10-hour day, and then the city employees of Philadelphia joined the strike for the 10-hour day. And after about 3 or 4 weeks, the strike was won. All of the workers of Philadelphia gained the 10-hour day for the first time, including city employees. Now, they were not locked out. They were not destroyed. They were not dismissed from their jobs. It was regarded as something which had to be negotiated with and dealt with. Generally, that's what happens. This is very unusual in that sense. In fact, the New York Times had an article on August 19th, 1981, just a few weeks ago, and was headed Execution of a Union. And it said, for the first time in American history, the government is going out deliberately to destroy a union. I might add that the New York Times editorially Sunday joined the ranks of the executioners by saying that if it's time now for the president to show a little mercy, having beaten and broken the union, and mercy in their eyes is to take back part of the PATCO strikers, but they should lose their negotiated wage increases, their seniority, or any perks earned by seniority. Those controllers who have worked through the strike would be rewarded with better pay. In other words, if you're a scab, you're rewarded. It's like the old theory of President Charles W. Eliot of Harvard University, that the scab is the American hero. That most workers don't accept that. And then they go on to say, to ensure the rehiring of illegal strikers does not encourage other illegal strikes, PATCO, the strikers' union, would lose recognition as the controller's bargaining agent. So they're also in the executioner's chair in that sense. But that would be very unprecedented. But it can happen, you see. The danger is that once you do that with PATCO, you're going to move on to do it with other unions. And you'll set up a precedent that if unions do things which the government doesn't like or employers don't like and the press doesn't like, they can be destroyed in the same way. You're setting up a very dangerous precedent. In fact, the Times admitted it. In its editorial, it had this to say. It said that by refusing to cave into this illegal strike, the president has set a commendable precedent that is already paying dividends in relation with other unions. In other words, it points out that the postal workers accepted the agreement, even though they didn't like it, for fear that their union might also be destroyed. Well, next is other unions are going to be told, if you don't like it, you'll get the PATCO treatment. So it's a very big issue.
My guest is Philip Foner. He's a labor historian, and we're talking about his analysis of the PATCO strike and labor history and labor precedents that come into play in the understanding of the PATCO strike and the precedents that it can create. We're going to open the phones for any questions or comments that you have. If you'd like to get through, our number is 923-2774. We're at area code 215. The number again is 923-2774 for your questions and comments on labor or the current PATCO strike. Now, we're talking now in times of great unemployment. And it seems to me, I haven't done any formal surveys, but it seems to me that a lot of people feel that the members of PATCO, for instance, have it pretty well. That they're getting paid a good salary. It's a prestigious job. They're white-collar workers. They have excellent government benefits. And for someone who's maybe unemployed now, living on next to nothing, having a hard time getting by and keeping a family together, it seems to a lot of people that they're really overstepping their bounds, and it's about time that someone put the limits on them. Someone just said, okay, this time you've really gone too far.
Well, if so, then it should be by someone who doesn't acknowledge that their grievances are justified. Because when President Reagan was running for president in the 1980 campaign and sought the vote, successfully, by the way, of PATCO to support him, in his letter, which was published, by the way, in most papers as an advertisement by other unions, he acknowledged that their grievances were great. He said that one of the first things he would do if elected would be to set up a very keen study. And you're not correct in what you said. If their conditions were that wonderful, I guarantee you, you wouldn't have a strike now. I mean, whatever you might say about PATCO, they're not idiots. The reason they went on strike and the reason why their wives support them down the line, and incidentally, that is very interesting because one of the things in labor history is that wives sometimes don't support their husband in strikes. They feel maybe the family is endangered by losing income, etc. And of course, it works the other way too. Wives of miners and others played a very big role. But in this case, most of the wives supported their husband down the line. Why? Because they know that these men who are their husbands come home terribly exhausted from the strain of the work, the tension, and the difficulty of the work. And if you consider the amount of... Well, look, in order to replace these air controllers, even Lewis, the air secretary of transportation, admits it will take 2.5 years of training. Therefore, these are not people who just can get on the job at a moment's notice. So what's so remarkable about the wages they're earning in view of the long training and the skill and the importance of the job they have? So I can match that with people with less important jobs who make a lot more. Secondly, the wage question was not the main issue. And had the other issues been properly negotiated, that could have been easily solved. The main issues were the long hours. After all, they work longer hours than air controllers in any other country in the world. Now, that's a terrible situation, that we have air controllers working for the government of the United States who work longer hours than air controllers in other countries. And we're supposed to be the most advanced country in that, in our treatment of labor in many ways. And also the retirement. So the president acknowledged it.
Okay, we're going to take some phone calls. My guest is labor historian Philip Foner. If you have any questions or comments, our phones are open at 923-2774. We're at area code 215, and the number again is 923-2774. And there are some open lines if you'd like to get through. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, hi. This is for Mr. Foner. Presumably, if a union does not have the right to strike, the law would somehow protect them by giving them some other, let's say, teeth. I'm wondering if somewhere it's written that if a public union does not have the right to strike, are they therefore given, you know, the right to binding arbitration, or what other means are there available for unions if they are not permitted the right to strike?
Well, you've raised an interesting question, because actually now some labor economists and scholars are saying that we've got to do just what you say should be done. We've got to, if you're not going to have the right to strike, then what good is the negotiation? Because if you can't strike at a certain point, the employer, and whether it's government or not, will be able to say, we refuse, and what can you do about it? You can't strike. You can just... So they're calling for an institution of binding arbitration now, or what is called the last offer deal. In other words, both sides present their last offer, and the arbitrator selects one of the two, and that's binding arbitration. But that's in the pot right now. Whether it will be adopted is open to question. But I would say the answer to your question is no, there is no way in which public employees who do not have the right to strike have a substitute at present. That's one of the problems of public employees. There is no substitute, even though they are deprived of that right.
We are a union, but we're emasculated.
Well, that's widely believed, that that collective bargaining without the right to strike is just a paper right, and therefore it's a farce to speak of just because you agree to it that you can enter into effective collective bargaining.
Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi. I would like to ask Mr. Foner if he could comment on the issue of the Legal Services Corporation employees having their right to strike taken away under the present legislation in front of Congress. I believe it's H.R. 3480. And does he believe that, number one, is it necessarily legal, or number two, is it a portent of things to come for further legislation against unions generally or public employee unions?
Of course, since the right to strike being taken away is not unusual for public employees, I can't say that this marks a vast departure. But any weakening of a particular group at in the present atmosphere is part of a general attack on labor, which is developing on a pretty big scale. And this is reflected not simply in the PATCO strike. It's reflected in the idea that workers have to make sacrifices in order to enable employees in the industry to survive or to continue. In the end, it's the workers who are asked to do most of the sacrificing, and without any guarantees, by the way, in most particular cases. So I think we're in for a period of very sharp attacks on the labor movement. This may have the effect at the same time of exacerbating conflict within this country. You can't attack the workers, as the administration is doing in this particular instance, without creating a feeling among many workers that they are the targets of a big conspiracy against them, and this will create more solidarity on the part of labor. It's done that in the past, and I would think that we're going to have some very sharp struggles ahead.
Thank you.
Thanks for your question. My guest is Dr. Philip Foner. Our number is 923-2774. We're discussing labor history and precedents and also things that have bearing on the current PATCO strike. If you have any questions or comments, we have open lines at area code 215-923-2774. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Okay, I want to compliment Mr. Foner for the concise manner in which he presents labor problems or labor history. But I'm a retired worker, and I've been through strikes. And one thing we did learn was that arbitration and mediation is nothing but a trap if we couldn't resolve our problems between the company and the union and the men. Why, the companies would generally drag us through arbitration, and we'd have some of our best stewards and officers out on the street or home where when they were should be in the shop with the workers. And the point should be made and reemphasized that workers don't go out and strike just for the fun of it. It's a serious matter. And when a group of workers go on strike, it's there's generally very serious matters involved. But the thing with the PATCO that really struck me was the fact that they were sold themselves for a promise from Reagan. And that has been the case with labor so long in the United States that I think that this is going to be a turning point in labor history, because this is the only country in the world where we vote for millionaires and the boss's candidates instead of voting, having a party of our own. This is the only advanced country. I like to have Mr. Foner comment on that aspect.
Well, you raise quite a few points. I'll just comment on one or two of them. First, on your last point, it's not uninteresting that you make this point about a labor party in a city where the first labor party in the history of the United States came into existence. And that's in Philadelphia in 1828, the Workingmen's Party of Philadelphia, which nominated candidates for office. So it's not unusual to have labor parties. We've had labor parties before. And I think in a major sense, that the Reagan administration's policy towards labor and the utter bankruptcy of the Democratic congressmen and their failure to stand up for at least what the Democratic Party is supposed to stand for,
right,
is going to intensify the feeling that perhaps the time has come to think in terms of a new party of led by labor. So I would say that that's a possibility. On the question of strikes and arbitration, I think that the public generally, and for this I think our textbooks in the high schools and public schools are to no small extent to blame, get the impression that workers just go out on strike at the drop of a hat, and that all the labor movement consists of is a history of strikes and violence. That is not the case. A strike means a period of sacrifice. After all, it means that the worker does not, in most cases, unions don't even provide strike benefits. So it means that you're willing to live without a income for the time of the strike. And yet, workers have learned from experience that unless they do go out on strike, they're not going to make any advances at all. If it wasn't for the right to strike and the use of the strike, workers would still be working 18 to 16 hours a day. And 6 days a week, and in the steel industry of Pennsylvania, they were working 7 days a week as late as 1922, and every Sunday they worked 24 hours. And the reason why these were changed is not because of the goodwill and the humanitarianism of the employers, but because of the strength of labor, which was often expressed in strikes.
Thank you very much for your phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. My question is this, what is Mr. Foner's authority for saying that the only issue in the strike or that the most serious issue is not money but working conditions? I had heard Drew Lewis say that in his initial discussions with PATCO, resulting in the agreement which was ultimately rejected, that all that was discussed was money, and that the package that was agreed to came to $40 million, and that after PATCO went out on strike, the demands amounted to, I think he said, $700 and some million, including a salary increase of $10,000 per air controller. And my other question is, if that is right, has PATCO ever, since the strike, withdrawn any of those demands and focus solely on working conditions?
Well, it's these general statements of millions and millions and millions of dollars were just thrown out of the thin air. I don't find any specific examples to say, well, this is what they wanted in a very clear way. I didn't say that the money question wasn't part of the package. I said that that in judging the interviews with members of PATCO and officials on television and what I myself have heard and talked to people in PATCO is that the main reasons why the workers went on strike and why their family supported them was on the question of working hours and the question of retirement. The other factor was there, but it was not the main factor, and I think myself that it could have been settled had the government been willing to yield on those other two issues. And I don't see what would have been so catastrophic about yielding in these two issues, particularly since it would have been better for the safety of the passengers anyway.
Well, go ahead.
Well, I think what has caused some of the antagonism toward the air traffic controllers has been a public perception of a union that has said, listen, we're going to close down the system, or we're going to close down the country, and we want this package of, as I say, the figure that I heard Drew Lewis say was $740 million, including a $10,000 increase per man.
Yeah.
And it is true that now that's what the individuals, when you hear them talk about, they do talk about safety, but I don't know that the union has ever withdrawn any of its figures. And I think that's really what caused a lot of antagonism.
Well, first of all, let me point out to you that Lewis is not the authority on what the union wants. You wouldn't come to say that what the union wants in negotiations is what the publicity of the employers hands out. So I haven't heard the same kind of thing from representatives of the union. So if you could cite me examples of the union where they said what you're saying, I would may have more value. But just to quote Lewis doesn't cut too much ice, since he has a definite desire to indicate that what the union wants is very unjustified. But I would say that I'm sure people have heard the people from PATCO indicate that they're willing to negotiate these issues. The government has just taken a position they don't exist anymore. Well, how can you function and settle a strike under those situations?
Thank you very much for your phone call.
Okay, thank you.
In what you were saying, though, it's possible that the union would intentionally after the strike became unpopular amongst many Americans, that the union would intentionally play down monetary figures, play down raises in salary, because that it is an unpopular time now
well,
to ask for raises.
Well, you may remember that when the strike broke out, the very first day, CBS, ABC, NBC interviewed PATCO members on picket lines in New York, Chicago, O'Hare, Los Angeles, and invariably, they even went into the homes of one or two of the members. Invariably, the major emphasis was on the working conditions. I hardly heard anybody say anything about the wages. Now, this is not after the strike had been on for 3 or 4 weeks. This was immediately after. And I am convinced that had there been a willingness to deal with these questions, this thing could have been settled.
Okay, my guest is Philip Foner, labor historian, and we're talking about the PATCO strike and some of the history and precedents that come into play in understanding the PATCO strike. Our number is 923-2774 if you have any questions or comments. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, I'm Terry, Mr. Foner. I just don't see how you can ignore the fact that this is very peculiar case in that a condition of employment was the fact that these people did not strike. And I wonder why they didn't do everything in the world that they could do to change the status. So, I mean, there's why should the government be providing a service for a private industry?
Well, that's another question. Namely, there are some people who have written articles, experts in the field, who say that there should not be a government set up for air controllers. But that's not going to be solved overnight. There are different views on this question. But it does throw an interesting light on the issue. Namely, if it wasn't for the fact that the government is providing the service and these employees are therefore under the government, the situation would be quite different.
Well, I mean, much as I dislike this administration, I do feel that they're anti-labor and that they're devoted to the good of a very special privileged class. I just think that in this case, Reagan had no other alternative.
Why not? What would have been what?
Because clearly it was against the law.
But he is not, then you must say that President Richard Nixon, a Republican, betrayed the American people by negotiating with the postal employees who had no right to strike.
Yes, I see, but I don't know.
You would have to say that every mayor of Philadelphia who has negotiated with public employees who violate rights to strike, or in New York City when they negotiate that they violate the Taylor Law, are also betraying it. But the truth is that in life itself, it becomes very difficult to carry into effect a law which is so patently difficult to enforce, namely it making a special category of workers just because they happen to be public employees.
Well, I mean, that's true, but I mean, that's the way it is. I mean, there are people that you would not like to see strike. I mean, you would not like to see policemen strike or people in the army or various other groups of people.
Well, first of all, you can't put everyone on the same level. The army is quite different than other types of public employees. But just because you wouldn't like to see those people strike doesn't mean that they should be destroyed as an organization because of your desire not to have them strike. If they go on strike, then you have to ask yourself why did they go on strike? You say President Reagan had no alternative. Then why did he promise them in the letter that he wrote to them when he was running for office that their grievances were legitimate and would be taken care of? So when nothing was done really to deal with these grievances and they resorted to strike, suddenly he had no alternative. Well, he shouldn't have made the promise in the first place.
Well, just let me say this in closing, that anybody that would believe a man running for office, and particularly a Reagan, who seems to be an amiable front guy from a very terrible group of bloody-minded people, really shouldn't have taken him at his word.
Well, that's all right. That was a question, for example, today in the New York Times, Jerry Wirth of the State County Municipal Employees Organization faults the PATCO union for having supported Reagan and deserting the rest of the labor movement that generally supported Carter. But it's a union with very little labor experience. This is their first strike, and they showed it, by the way. They learned a lot in the process. But I just want to make one point in this connection. The PATCO is not the only union that supported Reagan. The Teamsters supported Reagan. You will notice that the Teamsters are not the union that one has a reputation that one can speak of with great pride. And in their last convention, when the person who was nominated for president was being indicted by the federal government as because of association with corrupt practices, the Reagan sent representative of his administration to that convention. Now, why did he deal with the Teamsters with great, and in fact, they showed the film of President Reagan addressing that convention. Why was he honoring a union that supported him and destroying a union that supported him? Because PATCO has got only 12,000 members, doesn't mean anything, and you can get a great deal of political mileage out of destroying PATCO. But if you start out with the Teamsters, you got another guest coming.
Thanks very much for your phone call. Bye-bye. If you're just joining us, my guest is labor historian Philip Foner, and he's the author of many volumes of books on labor, African and Afro-American history. We're taking your phone calls if you have any questions or comments. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Oh, okay. My question for Dr. Foner is that watching the strike progress as the months and as the weeks go on, I'm a little bewildered in that I don't see any other unions contributing to the strike effort, and the reluctance of them to not contribute somewhat astounds me. Has he been able to figure out why PATCO cannot seem to get other unions, especially airport-related unions, to go into sympathetic strikes with them?
Well, support can be of various kinds, and I don't want to apologize for anything. But first, you're not quite right in saying that there has been no support. For example, the American Communications Workers, the ACW, about a week or so ago, contributed $100,000 from its treasury for the welfare of the families of the PATCO strikers and acknowledged and stated that it was ready to give $1 million from its treasury to support the PATCO strikers' families. Now, that's support. I mean, it may not be they can't do very much more there because they're not tied in with this. First, I want to point out that it's not easy for other unions to give the kind of support that you've asked for. I want to explain why, and yet at the same time, I recognize the point you make has a lot of value to it. It's not easy because under the Taft-Hartley Act, it is very difficult for unions to conduct sympathetic strikes, and they can find themselves under a great deal of attack from the courts and from employers. That is, they can be fined astronomically for every day that they're out on strike. Members can be punished, and the legal weapon is there to be used against the unions. So that's the first thing we have to remember. That's one of the results of having these kind of laws which are out to break the power of labor, and it has worked in more cases than one. At the same time, if they succeed in preventing labor from supporting a fellow union group on strike, it means that labor is not fighting back sufficiently and may find itself under great stress. As far as those in the industry are concerned, that's not unique. We have in America two traditions in the labor movement, a great tradition of labor solidarity, Philadelphia happens to be a very good city to talk about that, since the only city in which there were two general strikes occurred was Philadelphia, one in 1835 and one in 1910. But we also have a tradition of what was called by union people union scabs, separate agreements between unions in the same industry, which expired at different times and operated at different times. And so when one union went on strike, you find the other unions continuing to work. And that often defeated many strikes within the American Federation of Labor. That's one of the reasons why industrial unionism emerged, in order to bring about an agreement within an industry that covered all the workers in the industry. Unfortunately, it did not apply in the airline industry.
Okay, another question that just cropped up as you were saying this. I am convinced that the controllers are having a difficult time with their job. I mean, just hours per week that they work and the type of job that they work with and the responsibilities that are above and beyond what ordinary people would have to do to endure during the day. Let me see if I can phrase this. The pilots don't seem to want to support the controllers at all. They don't acknowledge that there's a lot of stress in the controller's job, and there just doesn't seem to be any, if only verbal, confirmation of this over stress or this burden that the controllers have. Do you know why that is?
Well, basically, it's because the pilots are not supporting the strike, and since they're not supporting the strike, they're actually doing something to give strength to the opposition. And I'll give you another reason. When one pilot, member of the Air Pilots Association, mentioned over the speaker in his plane, this was an U.S. Air plane, that one of the reasons why they were having difficulty is because of the inexperience of the controllers, and that this was a reflection of the failure to solve the problem. When his plane landed, he was informed that he was removed from his post for daring to say that.
Right.
Well, that's an intimidation of other people.
Thank you very much for your phone call.
Thank you.
Before we get to the next call, this question I'd like to ask. We've been hearing your analysis of the PATCO strike and on the precedents that the way this is being handled are creating. What's your analysis of the possibility of the teacher strike or of the requests that Mayor Green made last night of the teachers' union?
Well, my own
personal
express.
We don't have a lot of time to cover this.
I know we don't have a lot of time. I'll simply say this. If the mayor expects the examples of Chrysler and other example he mentioned of
The Bulletin.
The Bulletin, to be analogous to teachers, I think he is barking up the wrong tree, because it's a different situation. And moreover, there are no people who are interested in contributing to keeping Chrysler alive or the Bulletin alive. But there are forces in Philadelphia, the oil refineries, the major companies and others, who can be asked to make a greater contribution and not ask the teachers to carry the main burden. And it seems to me that this was ignored by Mayor Green, and I feel that that means that the teachers are being asked to carry a burden which is something that others should be sharing. And there is another principle, but it is, namely, the mayor, after all, did agree to these terms. Now he's saying he made a mistake. Well, how valid will future contracts be between the teachers' union and the city if they can say, well, sorry, things have changed, we made a mistake? So you're setting up a precedent which can injure not only the teachers, but all employees in the city in future negotiations.
Very briefly, there's a number of unions that have been being asked to either not take wages or to take cutbacks in their salaries the argument that's given is because there's inflation is so high, there's been so many cutbacks to various programs that it's hard for everybody to keep up in this spiraling spiraling wave. How do you define the difference between compromise for the mutual benefit of labor and industry, or labor and management, and blackmail of unions? What's the difference between the two, as far as you're concerned?
Well, blackmail of workers is an old tradition. Runaway shops, for example, has a long history. Workers were told, unless you take cuts, the shop is going to leave. What often happened was the workers took the cuts, and then the next year the shop left anyway. Because nobody said, okay, workers take cuts, therefore let's give them a right to participate in the determination of what the industry will be doing. The workers have to take the cuts, but the decision is still with the employers, in which the workers have no rights. Workers can take cuts year after year. And then on the following year, the industry can post a sign suddenly, without any warning. From next week, the industry shuts down. We're moving to the Sun Belt, or maybe to South Korea, or to Mexico, or some other place. What is missing is the right of the workers who have made these sacrifices to have a voice in the determination of these things. All they ask them to do is to make the sacrifice, but they don't say to them, because of your sacrifices and your contributions, you now shall have a share in determining the future policies of the industry. That's always in the hand of industry, and always the decision is what the end profits will be. So very often workers make sacrifices, and they come out with nothing anyway.
We're not going to have time for any more phone calls, so my apologies to those of you who have been holding, waiting to talk with Dr. Foner. We have about 2 minutes remaining. Is that enough time for a short history
of the labor movement in the United States?
No, of Labor Day.
That's approaching, Mo. But there is one thing we have a few minutes, a moment for, and that is, and I think Philadelphia is entitled to it. There is a story going around, which is being given a great deal of play on the television tonight in New York on Channel 13, that the centennial of the American labor movement is occurring at the present time. And that implies that with the birth of the American Federation of Labor in 1881, the American labor movement began. That is not true. The American labor movement began in the city of Philadelphia in the year 1827 with the formation of the Mechanics Union of Trade Associations, the first city central labor body formed anywhere in the United States. That is a labor movement. William Highton, who was a shoemaker, very interesting person, was the who started it. He was the founder, also the first labor paper published anywhere in the United States, the Mechanics Free Press of Philadelphia. So I think in the interest of historical accuracy, we ought to give Philadelphia its due.
Well, I want to thank you for spending this last hour of Fresh Air with us. I've been speaking with Philip Foner. He's a labor historian who's written over 80 books on the subject of labor and black history. His books on labor include his 5-volume History of the Labor Movement in the United States, Organized Labor and the Black Worker, and his recent 2-volume book, Women and the American Labor Movement. He's been a professor of history at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, a visiting professor at Rutgers. Tomorrow he leaves for China, where he will be teaching courses on American labor at a university there. In the winter, he'll be teaching a semester at a university in Cuba on the history of the American labor movement. And I hope that in between visits, he could join us again on Fresh Air and tell us